Well, good evening and welcome to the fifth presentation in this our 13th series of talks on faraway places with strange sounding names sponsored by the Friends of WKU Libraries. My name is Brian Kutz, and as head of the Department of Library Public Services, I coordinate this series with my colleague in the back, Peggy Wright, and with help from our webmaster, Haiwan Wan, and our instruction coordinator, Brian Carson. Christian McConnell designed our posters, and our technical specialists tonight are Shadon Melke and Eric Fisher. Our speaker tonight is a native of Memphis, Tennessee, who moved with his family early in life to Bowling Green. And growing up, he wanted to be Indiana Jones, or a firefighter, or a professional skateboarder, and was influenced by Tony Hawk, 80s movies, and skate rock. After graduating from Bowling Green High School, he enrolled in the photojournalism program at WKU, and he says his passion for photojournalism came from a WKU student, David Burton, who was assisting his high school yearbook class. Throughout his whole college career, he worked for the Bowling Green Daily News. He began working for WKU in 2008 as the university photographer, and his responsibilities include nothing less than the visual image of the university. His pictures have been featured in or on nearly every university publication and website. An experienced world traveler, he's photographed in Germany and in China. And in the summer of 2012, he accompanied a summer research expedition to the Cordillera Blanca of Peru, led by WKU geographer John All. The expedition was made up of scientists, students, and climbers who gathered more than 100 snow and ice samples and dozens of water quality samples and other atmospheric data for future analysis. Here to share spectacular photographs from the expedition is university photographer Clinton Lewis. Clinton.
Hello, thank you for coming out tonight. This is supposed to be an epic tag team presentation, but my cohort, John All, had an opportunity for a fundraising effort down in Chattanooga tonight. We always need money. he couldn't be with us tonight, so you get me. I'm just going to take you chronologically through our 2011 expedition that I was lucky enough to tag along with. I'll just get right to it. The first thing is, being that John All is from geography and geology, we have to start off with a geography lesson. So where is Peru? Peru is down on the Pacific coast of South America. And my first thought was Pacific coast, South America, it must be way over Pacific or further time zone. Well, actually, the way that the two continents are laid out, it's kind of like somebody sprawled out on the couch. Whereas San Francisco and Seattle are up near the armpit, Peru is way down by the bend of the knee. Where we were in Peru is this little sliver of the Huascarán National Park, which is actually about the same latitude as Raleigh, North Carolina. So we were actually in the Eastern time zone, which made calling home when the satellite phone was available a lot easier, that I didn't have to compensate for 6-7 hours time difference. That was really great. So we fly in to Lima, and then we take a grueling, nausea-inducing bus ride through the mountains. It's about 8 hours just to get from Lima here to Juarez, which is about right in the middle of the national park range there. And this is generally the Huascarán National Park, named for Huascarán Peak, the highest peak in Peru. And our base camp was right here in Juarez, a tiny little town of about 100,000. The way that I actually got involved with the trip was just a really off-the-cuff, happenstance conversation that Dr. All and I had. I knew that he had been to Everest. That was big news for the university in 2010, 2009. When he made the summit of Everest on the much more difficult Northeast Ridge without crampons, even because global warming and climate change has affected the area so much that there's almost no ice on that side of the mountain. It's almost all rock. So if you see his photos, you'll see that on his boots, they're just his regular climbing boots, not, he doesn't have the crampons or anything that a lot of the other folks did. So we had a big scout. I'm involved with scouts. Both of my sons are scouts. I'm an Eagle Scout myself. Our troop was in charge of January, where we honor all the Eagle Scouts and all the younger Arrow of Light kids. We thought it would be inspiring for Dr. All to talk about how scouts helped him prepare for climbing the highest mountains in the world. He wasn't able to actually be there, so I did a video beforehand. We got to talking about climbing. He says, hey, if you're not doing anything this summer, you should go to Peru. That's a great idea, because I was already a rock climber. It was a lot of fun, so, you know, why not? You know, go big or go home. And it ended up having everything fall into place 4 weeks before departure date, so that didn't leave me much time to get physically in shape, and we'll talk more about that, because that kind of defined the whole trip. Preparation is worth everything for this. My slideshow just got set up kind of in chronological order, so we'll just take you right from when we're in Lima. Our mountain of gear, this is us in the bus station, ready to head out, and the Pacific coast of Peru. Funny thing about Peru is that everything is opposite of what we're used to here. You won't recognize a star in the sky. Their weather system goes from east to west instead of west to east like we're used to. The coast, we think of our coast as very wet, very moisture, especially the west coast. California, Seattle, it's always raining in Seattle. Not so in Peru, because all the weather comes from the Amazon, hits the Andes, and stops. So there's very little rain in and around the coast of Peru, especially in Lima, where there's just kind of this weird haze mist all the time. It's like all the depressing parts of Seattle, but without actual rainfall. And if you go to the southern part of Peru, in the desert, it's one of the driest deserts in the world, because the weather can't physically get over the mountains to actually drop a centimeter of water, I think, a year that they get there. Something ridiculous. So this is on the bus ride up to Juarez. Inca Kola is a huge drink there in Peru. And it's pretty good. It's kind of like Mountain Dew, ginger ale, kind of with a little twist to it. It's interesting. If you go down to Atlanta to the Coca-Cola World of Coke, they actually have it there. We went last summer and made my family drink it all, and about less than half of them liked it. When it's the only thing that's available, when you come down from a mountain, you buy a liter of it and you chug it, and it's wonderful. This is in an alleyway in our base camp town of Juarez. Being a rather rural town, it is surrounded by the native Quechuan farmers, which are descendants from the Inca Indians millennia ago. Just really generous, hardworking, very neat, colorful people. You'll see a mixture of photos from the one camera I took, my big camera, as I call it. I shoot the Canon 5D Mark II. I took just the one camera body, SLR, and one lens, and that gave me the option to do photos and video. I took a little point and shoot, my Canon G9, that I used infrequently, mainly because I only had one battery and it didn't hold a charge very well. And then I shot a lot on my phone, using not only regular photos, one of my favorite apps, Hipstamatic, and it kind of does cool, funky things. So when I was preparing, the camera gear was actually the least important thing on my list, because I knew that, are there any photographers here other than Haiwan and John? As you guys know, the quality of your lens is directly proportionate to the weight of the lens. So if you have a really good lens, it tends to weigh a lot. Weight is not good when mountain climbing. You kind of want that to be high quality, but very low weight. I left all of my really good lenses here in the States because I couldn't justify the weight. Like I said, it was my first time in the mountains. I needed to learn how to climb a mountain properly before I started tacking on a bunch of extra weight that would slow me down even more than I already was. So I just had one small consumer level lens with my SLR. You know, that was my gear. Like I said, it was just the last thing on my mind was actual camera gear. I had a couple days to acclimate to the altitude of Juarez. Juarez sits at about 10,000 feet elevation, not much lower than the highest peaks in the continental US. What, Denver's mile high, 5,000? That's nothing. You get acclimated really quick at 10,000 feet. And part of that was just walking around one of the local markets. There's lots of hills and peaks right around Juarez. So one of the days we took a long hike up to one of the highest roads we could find. This is me overlooking the valley with Juarez behind them. That's the city with Mount Huascarán in the background at 24,000 feet. That's the highest peak in Peru. Looks really close. One of the three golden rules of mountaineering: it's higher than it looks, it's further than it looks, and it's harder than it looks. So, you know, that's actually a good 50 to 100 miles away. It's a massive piece of rock. The closest peak to Juarez is the twin peaks of Vian Rapi, which is really neat. I shot this just on the roof of our hostel that we were staying at. They do have Coke, so that was a saving grace. This is just what small town Juarez looks like. This is right across the street from our hostel, and our first trip was our training trip. From Juarez, we went along this road to a pre-Incan ruin called Wilcawain, on to Laguna Yaca, where we did all of our training, learned glacier movement. Like I said, our first stop was in the pre-Inca ruin called Wilcawain, which was really neat. It's been there for thousands of years. Not much is known. They actually let us go in and wander around. Everything's very hunched over. The Incas and their predecessors were very short, and of course, nothing would be complete without the sheep. Always got to have our alpaca sheep. The roads leading into the valley, to the Yaca Valley, were just like World's Craziest Road that are on Discovery Channel, where you kind of look out your window and you look straight down, exactly like that. Unload our three vans and more mountain of gear. I guess we had about 18 to 20 people on our expedition. You know, our different groups would break out. We'd each be assigned to mountain valley with one or two peaks, and groups of four or five would then branch out and tackle their scientific objectives. This is one of the highest altitude trees on the planet. It's a Kenua tree, I think. I'm not sure if I'm saying that right, but these grow up to 14,000 feet in elevation, where northern hemisphere, everything kind of dies out at about 6,000 or 7,000 feet. We call that tree line. Nothing really grows above that. Here, their tree line doesn't even get started until about 15,000, 16,000 feet. This is a small peak called Rima Rima. Looking back through the Yaca Valley as we're heading up to the actual glacier point. If you have any interruptions, comments, questions, not only are they welcome, they are encouraged. And then this is Laguna Yaca, the glacier leading up to the point, to the peaks, Aksapalka and Ranrapalka.
So how cold is that water?
It was pretty chilly. It's glacial runoff, it's probably just barely above freezing. There's some, you know, I wish Dr. All was here. He could give you the scientific reason for why the glacial lakes are really unnatural colors of blue, but it has something to do with the minerals and the dust and swamp gas reflected off of Venus. I don't know. More sunsets, some of the neat local flora, and sunrise and sunset. Interesting thing about sunrise and sunsets, when you're that close to the equator, is they happen very, very, very quick. They don't get the lazy half-hour, hour-long sunsets and afterglow. You got about 15 minutes, and the sun comes straight up and straight down. Spent a lot of time hiking up and around the glacier, Glacial Lake. Our first hike, we kind of went way up, and got up to about one of these points here, where we got to overlook the actual top of the glacier. And you can see how much the glacier has receded due to various effects. This was the actual extent of the glacier at its highest point 30, 40, 50 years ago. And it has receded this much to where that's the top right there. That's the toe of the glacier. And it is, you know, used to envelop all this area, but it's just constantly melting and sinking. And, you know, one of the main scientific projects is to find out why that happens. Self-portrait. That's during glacial practice training day.
Stylish,
yeah. Well, you gotta have the super thick glacier glasses. At 17,000 feet, there's not much atmosphere to diffuse the sunlight. You can get snowblind within minutes, because not only do you have the sun that's really bright, you have the reflection off the snow, which is really bright. These actually have like little leather things that go on the sides to really block out all sunlight.
What's your altitude there?
Here, this is about 12 to 13,000 feet on our hike up. When we got up around here, it's about 1,000 feet elevation gain, so our highest point at Yaca was about 14,000 feet.
Yeah, like one of the highest
feet.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yep.
Exactly.
What did you say was the highest point?
The highest point was Mount Huascarán, and it's about 23,000 feet, somewhere around there. That's another shot of me with Ron Rapalka and Oxapalka in the background with the very top of the glacier. And it was kind of neat because, you know, as we were, you know, all sitting around talking, we're like, oh, as we're walking up, we're like, you know, I just can't believe that we're in Peru. And I was with a lot of other, you know, folks that have been in the mountains for a long time and are more experienced mountain climbers. And they're like, oh, what's the highest you've been? Da 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 da. What's the highest you've been? Da 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 da. And like, they got to me and I was like, well, that's a record. That's a record. Every step was like, okay, this is the highest I've been. All right, 14,001, 14,002. So, you know, that was really neat. And, you know, they were all pretty appreciative and like, oh, that's so cool. You know, we're glad we got to experience, you know, that with you. So that was pretty neat. Our last day there, we took off and trudged through the glacial runoff to actually get to the toe of the glacier so we could get like a straight on look to it. And it's amazing the scale of it because it looks big, but you really have a sense for just how freaking big it is. Let's see. This is up on the moraine. Got on that side. That's Kevin, who I climbed a lot with. He is in the part like right there. He would be like a tiny speck right on that spot. And where we, a couple of guys brought ice axes and some crampons, and I learned to ice climb right there too. It's probably about 40 to 50 feet tall right there, and that's just on this very little side right here. So when you get to that point, you know, it's a couple hundred feet high, and it's just crazy awesome. And there's actually livestock that graze up in this area, and there's a cow. It's kind of hard to see, but he's like right in here. We had to stare off for a while because I was trying to hike right along this ridge on the moraine, and I didn't want him to charge me and send me off on this side because that would be bad. The other neat thing about being up in at that altitude is there's very little atmosphere to interfere with the stars. And the one thing I could recognize was the Milky Way. Amazing things happen when you have to go to the bathroom at 2 o'clock in the morning. Not only is it really cold and you have to shuffle about 200 yards to the bathroom, you get a chance to look up and go, holy cow, I've never seen stars like that. So I was standing there in my base layers, my long johns, and my coat going, I'm really cold. Do I go back to the sleeping bag or do I get my camera and stand outside for about half an hour and take pictures of the Milky Way? Okay, Milky Way wins.
No light pollution either.
Yeah, just a very little bit from the clouds here. There was a nearby town, but it was, you could barely see it as far as that. But just, you know, the night sky was just fascinating. Not only because you could actually see stars, like a million more stars than we're used to here, but I couldn't recognize a single constellation. Being the Southern Hemisphere, you know, there's no Big Dipper, no North Star. I don't know how anybody got around. I guess, you know, if you're from there, you know where the Southern Cross is, and, you know, they've got their own set of constellations, completely foreign to us, which was kind of neat.
How cold was it at night?
At night, it was in the teens. It was winter there. June here was a fairly mild winter. The highs were in the 30s and 40s, lows in the teens, so it wasn't too bad.
That elevation than 12,000. Wow.
I had a 0-degree bag, and it was adequate. Wasn't too bad. Just some of the other mountains on our way down. Epic clouds, which was awesome. One of the photos where I like to pretend that I was Ansel Adams. Back again to Huascarán, you can actually see the summit here. The wiring system of Juarez probably leaves a little bit to be desired. You know, that's a typical, this small Peruvian town.
What did you say the population was?
It was about 100,000. Yeah, it's a small town.
Did the food take getting used to, or the water problems?
We had some, you know, of course you have to boil the water and filter the water, especially when we were out at in the valleys and in the mountains, because, you know, one of the agreements when the Huascarán National Park was created, you know, 10, 15 years ago, was that the local farmers still had grazing rights. Well, with all the donkeys and cows and everything, they leave deposits everywhere. You just have to go in knowing that you're going to get some kind of stomach virus, because you can boil the water, you can filter it, but something's always going to get you. The food in town was actually great, because because it's not processed, it's all fresh, great vegetables, if you eat the right ones and if they're cooked. Chicken and fries was like a huge thing in Juarez. They had, you know, whole restaurants set up to just have chicken and fries, like a whole chicken or a half chicken or a quarter chicken. It's like literally the chicken just cut in half. It tasted great. It was actually harder to get used to food in the U.S. when I got back because everything is so overprocessed and full of junk. But there, it was just great. Chicken and potatoes, the biggest thing. Juarez is a pretty, being that it's the jumping off point for the Cordillera Blanca mountain range, they're used to cultures from all over the world coming and, you know, going climbing. So a lot of the restaurants were, you know, owned by, you know, French or Italian climbers, you know, that had, you know, come and gone forever, had families there. So, you know, some of the best pizzas owned by some Italians and, you know, everything. So it's a truly melting pot. It was really neat. Some of the colorful Quechuan locals, you know, they don't have the 6 o'clock news, but they've got the corner newsstand. That was my helmet that I borrowed from one of my friends. I gave him a sticker. That's Peruvian fashion. Yes.
So when you ordered food, did you have translated into another language?
No, they speak Spanish predominantly. There is the local Quechuan dialect that is, it's not a written language, it's a spoken only language. Of course, all the porters, everybody on our trips to the different valleys, you know, we had the Quechuan porters and a cook and everything. So they spoke mainly Quechuan among themselves, probably just to make fun of us. Because that was another big pastime, was making fun of the gringos. Well, they also spoke Spanish, and some of our mountain guides also spoke French, and they knew enough English that, you know, we could get by. Most of us on the trip, we were able to pick up enough Spanish just from being around them the whole time that we could order and kind of do, you know, really basic things. We were able to communicate in Spanish, not too. Once we got back from our Yaka training expedition or weekend, half the group went for more glacial training way over here at a different glacier called the Prasatori Glacier. After Dr. All and some of the other organizers made up the itinerary of which valleys and peaks we were going to be climbing, myself and a couple of the other guys we were assigned one of the higher peaks of the trip, and we decided that instead of going to another glacier, that we needed to actually go climb a peak to get acclimated, and they needed to train me on how to actually climb a mountain. Dave, Kevin, and I kind of split off, and we went this way up to the Ashinta Valley, and we could drive to about here, and then the rest is a walk, about a 13-kilometer walk. So we rented a taxi. He dropped us off at the trailhead, which is right here, and we said, all right, be back at 6 o'clock tomorrow. Awesome. So that was our timeline. So we hopped in, passed some Quechuan sheep farmers, which were just awesome, and headed on the trail to base camp, which is right down in here, right at the foot of Taklarahu, which is one of the more predominant peaks, which is the massif of that little area. And this was our base camp. There's a little refugio there, kind of like a boarding house or whatever. And we didn't anticipate how expensive that was. We ended up bunking, you know, watching a great sunset. We ended up bivvying in a cave that night, just down, you know, base camp from the refugio. So we're like, none of us really had the $60 a night to stay in the refugio, or 60 soles. And we're like, you know what? There's a cave right there. And this was sunset. This took all of 15 minutes. It got dark immediately. Like, we're going to be up at 1 o'clock in the morning to start hiking. That's where the term alpine starts comes from, because you need to get started earlier while everything is still frozen. Because otherwise, once the sun comes up, things get mushy and squishy, and snow starts to move in not-so-fun ways called avalanches. So we bivvied in a cave. Got up the next morning, got to the snowfield right as, which was about 4 miles away, got to the snowfield right as the sun was coming up. And this is the backside of one of the mountains from our training in Yaka. So this is Oxapalca that we saw the front side of a little bit ago. That's me, doubled over trying to breathe. That's Dave, was from Albuquerque, who spends his life in the mountains and was like skipping along. They put me in the middle so that I didn't drag both he and Kevin around. But it's at that point where you get on the glacier, you see the sunrise. You know, of course, as you can tell, we're in the shadow of the mountain, so it was freezing on this side. And just the slow, methodical movement of mountain climbing, you're like, that's when it just clicked. It's like, this is what they talk about when they say mountain climbing, freedom of the hills. It's just, it was amazing. The air was crystal clear. It was cold. We were just plodding along, step, 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 breathe. Step, 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 breathe. And step, 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 stop, take a picture. That's where it just all clicked. And that's where, you know, I really just got hooked on, you know, climbing in the mountains in the alpine environment. And we got just over the col, which is the shoulder between two peaks, is called the col, where we stopped and took a break, had some breakfast, and as soon as you got up on the col and you hit the sun, it's like you warm up about 20 degrees. So that's where we shed layers, change clothes, and keep climbing up. So a little portrait there, sun, bright, and then we keep moving up. So this is one of the final snow fields, final approaches to the summit of Ishinka, and our route would take us up through here, up to this part, and then try to make it up that really steep incline to the actual summit mushroom. This was our view looking back. This was that massive ridge that we saw a minute ago. This is the summit of Takarahu, and then that huge ridge that just dominated the sky as we were walking in.
So how can you see your camera or see through your camera with a glasses?
For this trip, I left my big camera back at the hostel. I just had my little G9, like I said, that had enough batteries for me to take a picture of the sunset and do a panorama when I got to my high point. Pretty much everything else was on my phone. So you just kind of, I think that's about, you know, right, just point and shoot, Hail Mary. And so this was as far as I got on Ishinka, you know, maybe about 300-400 feet shy of the summit. It's because I got really, really tired because I was really, really slow. And part of the reason I was so slow is that I borrowed a pair of boots that were about two sizes too big. And so that was not fun at all. By the time I was finished with this expedition this weekend, I had about, you know, 10 to 15 blisters, and then on our next leg of the trip, I had about 20 to 25 blisters all at the same time, and they all had names. So this was my high point. This is at about 17,500 feet, but that was the view when I turned around, and you see, you know, the ridge of Takarahu, the summit there, you know, one of the glacial lakes that was about 7,000-8,000 feet below. Our base camp was just on the other side of this ridge, way down there. Had I actually made it the last 300 feet up to the summit, we could have looked just over that little hump there and seen the Amazon rainforest basin, where it starts and heads into Brazil. So it looks like I'm going to be in this area again this year when I go back, so I have unfinished business with Ishinka. That last 200 feet is mine. I've been conditioning, hitting the gym for a year and a half to make sure that that happens, that I'm not the slowest person on the expedition this year.
And you've got the proper size boots this time.
Yes, and I have proper size boots that are actually a lot lighter than the ones I had. This was, you know, this is the Ishinka Valley. It's just amazing. And this was at about 10 o'clock in the morning. So we made it, we started climbing at 1, made it to this point at 10, made it back down, had to wait through a Peruvian traffic jam at the entrance to the park. Almost did a trail run to make it back, and made it to our taxi right at 6 o'clock. Even though I had both shoes unlaced, kind of walking on my heels. When we got back, we were supposed to have a day or two rest day to do laundry because, you know, again, when you're in the mountains, you kind of wear the same thing for weeks on end. So my base layers I had on for about 5 days straight. We get back to Juarez and we get the word that, oh, itinerary's changed. We're going to the Santa Cruz Valley tomorrow morning at 7. Pack and repack and get some sleep because we're heading out. Which was not fun because we needed a day to, you know, sleep, eat, do laundry, and call back home. None of that happened, unfortunately. We get up at the next morning. I tried to send an email, to let Kelly know that we're changing plans. I'm alive, even though we broke off from the group, and we're back, and now we're going with the rest of the group over to the Santa Cruz Valley. That email tried to send for 18 hours and never got out. So the last thing that Kelly knew was, oh, Dave, Kevin, and we're going to break away from the group and we're going to go climb this mountain. So finally, 10 days later, I was able to get back in touch with Kelly after she had already bought the burial plot, signed over the bill, and pretty much marked me up for dead. So anyway, to get to the Santa Cruz Valley, we hop on some buses out of Juarez, stop around Carhuaz for lunch, keep going all the way to Cachapampa, and that's where they dropped us off. We had to walk 25 kilometers, hang a left, and get to the Hidarahu and Albamayo base camp. Thankfully, because Kevin, Dave, and I had not slept, we stopped about midway right next to this lake, broke it up over 2 days, physically exhausted, not quite foaming from my mouth, but really close. Kind of collapse into sleep, eat a few chicken and fries, and go to bed. A few pictures along our way. Of course, the burrow is just synonymous with Peru and, the mountain areas. And this is the start to our trek into the Santa Cruz Valley. This is John there in the white shirt, and one of my friends that I made on the trip from Atlanta. John's research involved taking ground control points with a GPS and a camera. He'd mark off every 250 meters of walking. We'd stop, he'd take a photo in all 8 of the cardinal compass points, and then write down the composition of what he saw in a 30-foot radius. So, the percentage that was rock, the percentage that was, vegetation, ice, people, whatever was in that control point, he'd write down. And then the basis of his research is to take satellite photos going back, 30, 40, 50 years, and compare that to see how the land is changing, how the farmers are affecting the ground with grazing or agriculture, the rate of growth or retreat of the glaciers, any other major vegetation movement, animal movement. It's the basis of his research. We also had groups that were taking snow samples that they would carry, 20 pounds of snow back in big Ziploc bags that would be marked with, exactly where the snow was collected from, how deep, so that they could measure the amount of black carbon on the snow. Because the black carbon affects the reflectivity, and the darker the snow, the more heat it's going to absorb, faster everything melts. That was another component. We also did water quality testing, which with all the livestock in the area was generally not good at all. I wasn't allowed to give blood for a year and a half afterwards because we would go through all the farmland and I was tainted for a long time. We set up meteorology stations, take air quality samples, so the amount of research was just amazing. Everybody had a small part to do, and it just went off really well. So continuing up the Santa Cruz Valley, incredible rock formations, one of the local Quechuans. This was at our midway point where we camped out, and of course, being climbers, there's a big boulder. Got to get in a bouldering session. A really high altitude lake. That even had a full marshland and wetland area. This was at about 12,000 feet. This is the backside of Hidarahu, which was our target peak for this leg of the, maybe Albamayo. That was one of our target peaks for this trip. So we keep going a few kilometers, hang a left, go straight up to hit to that plain. Eventually we end up on the other side of that mountain. Another one of the high altitude trees. And then this is at our left turn at Albuquerque, looking back over the Santa Cruz Valley. What happened this past summer in 2012 was that one of the glacial lakes further up the valley broke, and a massive flood has gone through and completely wiped out this entire valley. All of this green vegetation up to about here and on this side is completely gone. It's been completely dry cleaned, almost. You know, very reminiscent of the flooding in Indonesia after their big earthquake and tsunami. Pretty much everything has been wiped out. It's just a big streak of white right now. And I couldn't, John sent me a picture, but I couldn't locate it, you know, to show you the difference, but it is drastic. And then this is our final trail leading into base camp. Sunrise the next morning. This is the peak Artisan Rahu. You may recognize it if you've ever watched movies. When the movie starts, you'll see a ring of stars go around this peak. It's the Paramount Peak, or the Paramount Pictures logo. This is the mountain that they base that off of. Sunrise, just the first hints of light. When we finally got to base camp, I had almost no sleep going up to that point. Our mountain guide said, we're going to camp for one night, and then we're going to start climbing 3,000 meters to get, you know, right up in here where we're going to set up an advance camp to try to hit the summit of Hitorahu. Well, I didn't make it that far. Not only was I completely and utterly physically tired, the sole of my left boot had come completely off. So it wasn't completely molded like this one. It was just kind of glued on at the bottom, so I had a flapper to about here. So I ended up about an hour behind the rest of the group. I had gotten off trail at least three times, just beyond tired. When I got to the top of the moraine, somewhere right around in here, I hadn't even gotten to the glacier field yet, that you just kind of blacked out for a while, dropped everything, camera, pack, trekking poles, and luckily landed on a fairly flat rock. Just kind of zoned out for about half an hour before a trekker from Colombia came by and was like, kind of poked me to make sure I was still alive. He's like, are you with that group that's like 45 minutes back on, you know, the snowfield? It's like, yeah, but I'm not going to make it. And he's like, no, you're going down. He's like, I'll go tell your porter and your group that I'm taking you down. It's like, you're not going any further. I'm like, sounds like a good plan to me. So we stumbled down a couple thousand feet back to base camp, and I got to watch the rest of my group try to navigate this ridiculous ice climb right here, because they were just little specks, and you can actually see them in a couple of these photos. Thankfully, it was a great sunset. I had, you know, the sunset on this side with them, and I turn around and see the sunset on Artisan Rahu. It's constantly, all right, this side, click, turn around, click, back to this side, click, show the whole valley, which was fantastic. So you can even imagine the ring of stars, Paramount Pictures. Back to keeping an eye on them, you can actually see one of the guys. It's just a speck, not much bigger than a pixel right here, but they're at the top of that pole.
How far away are they from here?
1,500 meters, at least, about a mile up. It was just not fun. I probably slept 14 hours that night. Woke up the next morning to that photo, and that's Alpa Mayo. Thankfully, the clouds just happened to part right at the perfect time to see the summit. And all I could think of was, wow, I really want to be up there. That's cool. Next year. I did force myself to keep active, so I hiked up to one of the nearby glacial lakes. You can tell I'm looking pretty miserable, wasted. That was the payoff. Great photo. Originally, they wanted me to navigate this really steep area and take an ice sample. Kind of got to looking at that and like, yeah, there's no way we can walk along the edge there without sliding in. We just kind of wrote that glacier off. There's just no way to get a sample from there. And to which I said, gracias. Of course, back to Art. From that high vantage point, just a neat shot of the valley leading up to Artisan Rahu. The glacial lake that burst last summer was right at the end of this, right around this corner here. So it burst all the way there and just went almost 15, 20 miles into Cachapampa, just completely wiping out everything.
Were people in the valley? Livestock?
I mean, there's always someone in the valley, but I'm not sure what the rate was, if there was any injuries or, you know, deaths or anything. But there was lots and lots of damage as far as just the trees. Another great shot of Alpamayo with the Southern Hemisphere stars. I had to get up right before sunrise. I'm like, gotta go to the bathroom. same issue. Sleeping bag, camera, camera one, thankfully. This is a 30-second exposure with just a hint of what we call rose light, which is sunlight reflected kind of off the atmosphere just before sunrise. It was really hard to focus. Made a pile of rocks to balance the camera on because the tripod is way too heavy. Rocks aren't going anywhere. So stayed up for a while photographing that. Made it back down. On the return trip, we hiked all 25 kilometers out in a day, to which I added about a dozen more blisters on my feet and a toe infection on my big toe. I was pretty much just crawling and crying by this point. It was not enjoyable.
Did you repair the boots?
Huh? Did you get to repair the boots?
Yeah. When I got back, I got some shoe goo, glued John's boots back together, and when he got back, I said, you better take these before I burn them. They were pink. I deemed them my pink boots of misery for the whole trip. They were awful. We made it back down to Cachapampa in time to kind of put our feet up and take my shoes off and let my feet air out and breathe for a second. Of course, we watched the kids play soccer. We ended up playing soccer with some of the kids there for a little bit. They may have you fooled, but they are tech savvy. They know what's going on. They see enough people going in and out. So as soon as you take the picture, they're right up next to you. Oh, let me see. It's like, I know you can see it on the back of your camera. Like, oh, we want to see. So we had a good time playing soccer and hanging out with them. That's our doctor, Alex, working on my feet. Nothing quite like rooftop surgery on my big toe, where he dug out a bunch of infection and then really went to work on all my blisters on my feet, which was a lot of fun.
Anesthesia?
Yeah, he numbed my toe before he stuck his scissors all the way up to my knuckle to dig the infection out. Right? It's just part of it. Kind of roll with it. So he probably, of course, it was afterwards that he commented feet were on this cooler, which was kind of nasty. He's like, yeah, I guess this wasn't the most sterile operating room. But it happened. I still have my toe, so it all worked out just fine. On the bus ride back down to Lima, where I had the bus ride, and then a white knuckle 45-minute taxi drive from the bus station to the airport, where you quickly realize that in Lima, traffic laws are more like suggestions, and the drivers are very aggressive. They pull out, regardless if it's a 5-ton truck that's barreling down the street. They're like, you're going to stop and let me out. About 3 years off my life in that 45-minute drive, which was ridiculous. When we get to the airport, by this time, I'm already pretty motion sick from the bus drive, which was no fun, and probably had a wonky steak the night before. Get to the airport, made the mistake of getting a burger at McDonald's, thinking it would be safe. Don't ever eat at McDonald's in the Lima airport. It's terrible. I was sick the whole flight back, 6 hours from Lima to Houston. Finally, after delay, after delay, after delay, I arrived in Nashville 30 hours after I left Juarez. Sick as a dog. I lost about 12 to 13 pounds on the trip. I had to eat a lot to at least get some weight back.
You could lose that much.
Yeah. Well, I kind of came back as a skeleton, as Kelly says. It was not fun for about 3 days afterwards. That's all I really have. Mm. Thank you. Good luck on your journey. That was our greetings in Cachapampa as we were leaving. One thing that just got approved this week was you can come join us this summer if you like. We just had our study abroad was approved for people to come. Our itinerary is much easier this year for this part.
Can I use my electric scooter?
Yeah. To where we'll just go in the Ashinka Valley. John is going to teach a couple higher level geography classes. I'll be teaching basic photo for non-photojournalism majors, so it's 100 class. A lot of fun. Get to do a lot of hiking, go climb one of the easier mountains in the area. So if that's something you're interested in, it's not on the Study Abroad website yet. It has been approved and we're ready to go. You should join us.
What is the fitness prerequisite?
You just have to be able to to hike a while.
On that note, we have time for questions.
Yes. Any questions?
Yes. Over here. Yeah.
You ate oil at last. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And of course, you know, potatoes are a huge thing in that part of Peru. There's just a rainbow of colors of potatoes. You know, as we drive on the buses to and from our different valleys, you'd see the local Quechuan farmers that just have their blankets full of potatoes on the side of the road where they trade with everybody. You have your purple potatoes, your orange potatoes, red potatoes, white potatoes, everything. It's just amazing to see. Yes?
Have you ever had coca leaves or the coca tea?
Yes. Yes, that was key, along with the prescription drug called Diamox, and helping acclimate to the altitude. The coca leaves are, it's not the chocolate cocoa, it's the other cocos to kind of get you going. So, you know, every time we get back to, you know, our base camp, they'd have a cocoa tea, or some of the more hardcore climbers would actually fold up some of the coca leaves and chew on that for a while, because that, like, really gets you going. But it's not, you know, I guess processed into cocaine, so it's not as addictive, although it gives you a good bump. And it helps your blood vessels and your blood be able to move oxygen better. And when you're at altitude, your body reacts. At that altitude, there's not as much oxygen. Your blood and your body have to create more red blood cells to move the oxygen you do get. When I was training, my 4 weeks of hard training that I had before I left, I could run maybe 3/4 of a mile before getting winded, having to stop and walk. By the time I got back, even though I had been in complete and total misery for the most part because of my feet, I was able to run a good 1.5 miles before getting winded, just because I, just in the 2.5 weeks that I was there, was able to increase, you know, some lung capacity, had a much better red blood cell count, and my oxygen absorption was pretty good, because we would test every time we got back to Juarez. Our doctor would take our vitals, make sure that we were still doing well and we were able to continue. Well, I was actually doing pretty well for the most part. When I got back, I was able to run and perform, you know, so much better. Just kind of kept that going, and now we're working out every day at Preston to get ready for the summer. Any other questions?
Other questions.
Do you advise to drink more water at the climate altitude?
Yes. Because of your respiration, and you're sweating, and you just have to really suck down as much water as possible, because the prescription drug Diamox that we're on that helps with that is a diuretic. You have to go to the bathroom more, so you constantly have to replenish fluids and drink as much water as possible.
That's why you talk about going to the bathroom so often.
Yes, that's why you go to the bathroom all the time.
Other questions back here?
Connor?
While you were there, when you saw the Milky Way, did you see any comets or meteors?
No alien ships. Not that we can tell. The skies were pretty bland.
No, but that's what Bob Donegan was supposed to be done.
Yeah.
Any other questions?
And then I've also got a bunch of my mountain gear. If you guys would like to take a look, you're welcome to entertain any questions about anything specific. Thanks for coming out. I appreciate it.
Thank you.